Today's Tesho will be on case 75 in the Book of Serenity. Case 75 is entitled Ryuan's Constant Principle. Introduction. Even as you call it thus, it's already changed. Where knowledge doesn't reach, avoid speaking of it. Here, is there any investigating or not? Ryuan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? Yanto said, moving. Ryuan said, when moving, what then? Yanto said, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Ryuan stood there thinking. Yanto said, if you agree, you are not free of sense and matter. If you don't agree, you'll be forever sunk in birth and death. Verse, the round pearl has no hollows. The great round gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body, resting on nothing, stands out unique and alive. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen today, this morning. It's really wonderful. I see when we practice in this room, people come in at various stages. So usually there's about 12 or 14 people who come first thing in the morning for sutra recitation, and they stay for the whole morning. And then there are people who arrive at 8 o'clock, and there are people who arrive at 9 o'clock and at 11 o'clock to hear the Tesho. And I see people come in, and it's not so different now. We start, and then people appear on the screen, and it's wonderful to see you here. It's wonderful to practice with you. In Buddhism, we say there are three gems, three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And everybody understands Buddha, everybody understands Dharma, but, you know, people don't necessarily appreciate how precious it is to practice with other people, to people who are like-minded and who have the same noble aspiration. You know, actually, such people are rather rare in the world. So, you know, meeting such a person is a really wonderful, wonderful experience. And practicing with others is really like nothing else in the world. It's the most wonderful thing. So it's really great to see all of you here today. You know, we do hear about. You know, stories of monks who practiced on a mountaintop and practiced by themselves. And there are people who have done that, like the great Xu Yun practiced for many years on a mountaintop in India, in China, by himself. Nevertheless, you know, throughout most of Xu Yun's life, he practiced with other people. He was the abbot of Nanhua Temple at one time. He was the abbot of a number of temples. You know, there's just something special about this collective energy that even the distance, our geographical distance, can't diminish. When one person sits deeply, everybody begins to sit more deeply. And it's just magical to see. Really wonderful. So thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning, and we can sit together in this beautiful way. I guess I'm I'm thinking about this because this morning when I was meditating, I was my mind went back to my sessions with Genki Roshi and Webb Roshi, and I can just remember sitting with them at Sesshin and just being so so grateful that they were there. And I'll never forget, this morning I remembered, as a matter of fact, the time when, you know, I was at a Sesshin, and it was the first time in my experience, my practice in Zen, that I had not stopped sitting at the bell. So, you know, we have a half hour period of meditation, and then the person with the inking, with the inching, the bell, rings it, and everybody is free to take a 5 minute break or a 10 minute break. And in my, at that stage in my practice, I had always taken the break. So as soon as that bell, it was hard enough to get through 30 minutes after, say, day one of Sesshin. And it's just like, if I can just hold out until he rings that bell, you know, it's like just breath by breath by breath by breath until he rings that bell. And it's like at the end, you're just thinking, come on, ring the bell, ring the bell, ring the bell, right? And then the bell rings and it's like, ah, you can relax. You can unfurl your legs and stretch a little bit and then get back. And I had always done that. And at a certain stage in your practice, you have to do that. You're just not able to sustain that body-mind focus for a long period of time. But this was, I think, day two of Sesshin, and even though I had some, you know, typical day two problems with my legs, I remember the bell rang, and Genki and Webb wouldn't move. They would just sit through the whole period. And I remember not moving and thinking, you know, do I dare to do this? You know, because I really didn't want to move in the middle of the sit. And I didn't move. And during the whole sit, it was just like, I was wondering if I could make it to the next bell. It's a little bit like being on a high wire and wondering if you can make it across the wire to the other side. And when it was over, I was in very deep concentration. It was like I don't think I had ever been in such deep concentration before. And I realized, oh, you can do this. You know, this is actually doable. There's a kind of deep samadhi you can get into, where, you know, you can sustain that deep, deep attention for longer than half an hour. First, you don't have the mental focus to do that. But eventually you develop that mental focus, that body-mind focus, I should say. And I remember sitting in the Zendo with Genki and Webb and sitting through that sit and realizing, wow, this is really amazing. You know, really amazing. I can do this. And I guess at the time I was very, very grateful for the Seattle Zen Center. I was really glad that Genki Roshi was a teacher and that Webb was translating and assisting. But, you know, I did not adequately appreciate how wonderful it was to sit next to Genki Roshi and how wonderful it was to sit next to Webb. You know, that collective energy, that practice was just extraordinary. And, you know, Genki Roshi was really an amazing sitter. I was thinking about him this morning. I used to go, we had a Zen center in South Seattle and at one time. It eventually changed locations, but my old friend, John Sunston, who was a neuroanatomist at the University of Washington in the medical school, would pick all of us up in his Volkswagen bus and drive to the Zen Center. Sometimes there were only two or three of us in the morning, and Genki Roshi would just come in and sit down, and you couldn't tell if he was dead or alive. He was in such such deep samadhi. Just sitting next to him, it was like the most wonderful experience. So anyway, thank you all for coming to practice Zen. It's wonderful to sit with each of you, all of you. Ryuan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? So I think we have an idea of what that's all about. You know, the fundamental constant principle. You know, when you first do Zazen, when you first begin to practice the great way, it's very difficult to get past your thoughts. So when you sit down on the cushion, you know, your mind is just full of thoughts and you're trying to focus on the breath. And the mind keeps following the thoughts instead of staying focused on the breath. And it's a struggle. You're pulling the mind back to the breath, And you know, your thoughts are absorbing, right? As soon as you begin to have one thought, they proliferate. The great Xu Yun, great Zen master Xu Yun, used to compare them to entangling vines. So he used to compare them actually to sweet potato vines. I don't know if any of you have ever planted a sweet potato for ornamental purposes, but you can buy a sweet potato at the store and you can stick it in a jar and you can put toothpicks in this sweet potato, and half the sweet potato has to stay in the water and the other half stays out of the water. And in a month, you will have this profusion of beautiful green vines. And actually, in some parts of the world, people eat those. Those are sweet potato vines, and you can stir fry them, and they're actually pretty good. But when you start thinking, the thoughts proliferate just like those vines. You know, it's like there's one little shoot, and then the thoughts just start proliferating, and pretty soon 20 minutes is gone, and you realize you haven't watched your breath. So that's the struggle of the beginner, right? It's trying to focus on the breath and the mind is wandering. And you know, one day people have an experience a little bit like the one I just talked about when I was with Genki Roshi. You know, one day you come in and you sit down on the cushion, and instead of struggling with your thoughts, you know, you're following your breath, the thoughts are sort of at the edge of your consciousness. And you begin to enter this place, which I'm sure everybody here has entered, where suddenly it's as though things are, there's a kind of stability or tranquility or serenity in that place. It's like, actually, it's like nothing is moving in that place. And if you haven't had that experience yet, if you're still beginning, please don't get discouraged. That will definitely happen to you. But you sit down on the cushion and you focus on your breath. And instead of struggling with your thoughts, you notice that the breath is at the center of your attention and it carries you forward. And all of a sudden, you'll notice you feel different. There's a qualitatively different feeling. You know, different people describe samadhi in different ways and experience samadhi in different ways. You know, my teacher Genki Roshi, since I'm on a Genki Roshi jag this morning, Genki Roshi used to say that he would come in and sit down on the cushion and he would feel like a stick of incense, and the top of his head was the top of the stick, and he would just feel himself disappearing from the top of his head down to his bottom, and he would just feel himself sinking into samadhi. It's like the samadhi, that stillness would be overtaking his body. And I myself, when I enter deep samadhi, I feel sometimes, not always, but I feel, when I was a kid, I used to have access to a pool, a diving pool. I was on the swimming team, and I would, after the practice, I would jump off the high dive. And I don't know how deep the diving pool is, but when you jump off the high dive, you go right down to the bottom of the diving pool. The water pressure at the bottom of a pool is markedly different than at the top of a pool. And when you're down there at the bottom of that pool, and you're feeling this heavy pressure on all areas of your body, it's a very interesting experience and actually really wonderful. So when I get into samadhi sometimes, that's how I feel. I feel like I'm down at the bottom of the deep end of the pool. I've talked to people, other people who have been doing Zen for a long time, and one of my friends said he felt like he was hollowing out. Another friend said he would feel like he was spider webs, right? He would just be like spider webs, just this light web. Now, if you haven't had any of these experiences, please don't feel anxious. Every once in a while, somebody will come up to me after I give a teisho and say, you know, that never happens to me, with a great deal of worry, right? Please don't worry. You know, if you haven't had any of these experiences, it doesn't matter. But some people have had these experiences, and they're sort of like signposts. You can kind of tell when you get into samadhi. It feels different. And the thing about samadhi is that eventually it becomes like this imperturbable stillness, this imperturbable stillness. It's pretty remarkable. You know, when I first started doing Zen, I had a hard time focusing my mind like everybody, but eventually I could get into samadhi, but if anything interrupted me, it was very upsetting, you know. So I could get into concentration, but then if they came down the street in a garbage truck and emptied the garbage cans, it was like somebody taking a piece of chalk and squeaking it across the, grinding it across the class, the blackboard, or like if somebody down the street had a skill saw going when I was trying to meditate, it was just like he was cutting through my head, you know. So initially, in early stages of samadhi, it's very nice, but it's easily interrupted. But if you keep practicing Zen, if you sit regularly, you begin to get into samadhi more regularly. And then, you know, eventually you get into a very, very deep samadhi, very deep. It's like, you know, really, in one of the koans, it says, you know, you can hit him with a stick and he won't even look at you. It's like, so the samadhi is so deep. And that is a really wonderful, wonderful place to be. You know, getting into deep samadhi is essential for Zen practice. And not everybody knows how to do that. And many people who meditate have never been in deep samadhi, believe it or not. Every once in a while, somebody will come to see me, and you know, people practice on their own without a teacher, and they form their own opinions. And a couple of years ago, a guy came to see me, and he said, "Listen, I think I'm enlightened." And I said, "Really? You know, that's great. You know." He said, "Would you like to ask me some questions?" And I said, "No, actually not. You know, I really don't want to ask questions, but what I would like to do is sit with you. Let's practice, let's sit together." And of course, after about 10 minutes, he was moving and shifting his posture. And when the meditation was over, he stayed behind and he said, "Well, what do you think?" And he said, "What stage am I at?" And I said, "You're a beginner." And he became furious at me. He was like furious. And he would actually write me menacing emails for a while, right? "You phony, you." But I was right, you know. He was incapable of getting into deep samadhi. In fact, he couldn't even get into light samadhi. So he was a beginner, whatever he had ideas he had formed. You know, when I would sit next to Genki Roshi, as I said, it was like the man was dead. Is he dead or not? You know, you couldn't tell. He was absolutely motionless. And it's like after an hour and a half, he would just leap up and we would go have breakfast. So that state of samadhi is difficult to achieve at first, and then it becomes deeper and deeper. Eventually that becomes like the foundation of your practice. No matter how much distress you might be experiencing, no matter how much anxiety you feel, you know, you can get into that place and it's really wonderful. So cultivating your samadhi power is an indispensable aspect of this practice. And in fact, it's one of the reasons to sit on a mat, right? Sitting in a chair is okay if you have a physical disability. But it's very, very difficult to enter into deep samadhi in a chair. It's actually much, much easier to sit in deep samadhi on a mat. It can be done. We certainly have people in our group who sit in a chair who are in very deep samadhi. But, you know, the body and the mind are like a little system or a little machine. And when you arrange the legs in a certain way, you arrange the back in a certain way, suddenly it becomes very much easier to enter deep samadhi. So, you know, one of the meditation postures is really ideal. In a chair, not so easy. So if you're, you know, wondering about the cushion, please buy a cushion and start sitting on the cushion. So anyway, the first part of this koan makes a lot of sense, right? Ryuan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? And, you know, if somebody asked me that, somebody said, what is the constant principle? It would be tempting to say unmoving, right? The unmoving, the motionless. Because, you know, when we're in deep samadhi, that's definitely how it feels, the motionless. So Ryuan asks Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? And Yanto says, moving. It's like, what? So that's the koan, right? You know, we've all, many of us have been practicing together for a long time. It's possible to get into deep samadhi, and when you're in deep samadhi, you're in this imperturbable, unmoving place. So Yanto doesn't say, oh, unmoving. Yanto says, moving. Ryuan says, well, really? When moving, what then? And Yanto said, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Ryuan stood there thinking. So, the goal of meditation in the early stages of one's practice is to get into deep, deep samadhi. You know, ideally, samadhi so deep that if somebody hits you with a stick, you don't even notice. It's like, oh, it's like a scratch. You know? That is an exaggeration, but you want to get into deep samadhi. And we experience deep samadhi as unmoving or motionless. But that's a stage in our practice, and it's not necessarily good thing, 100% good thing. You know, when early Buddhists, when the Buddha had his great awakening experience, he taught the people around him in northeastern India, in the region of the borderland between what is now Nepal and what is now India. And he was communicating to people in the language that he had available to them and in the culture that they all shared, right? So, you know, when the Buddha described enlightenment, he actually didn't call it the unmoving. In the Pali Sutras, he calls it the deathless, calls it the unborn. See, that's interesting. And when he taught, he taught sitting on a cushion, entering deep samadhi. But, you know, the people in the Buddhist time interpreted the experience of enlightenment as something completely outside this reality, right? Completely outside this reality. Like totally, we would say in our culture, totally transcendent, totally transcendent. So you know, early Buddhists, even though the Buddha didn't say this, early Buddhists thought of enlightenment as like completely erasing the world of form and existing outside of time and space, existing outside of time and space. And they thought of time and space as samsara. Right, samsara. So basically, enlightenment is motionless, timeless, immaterial, formless, and so on. And the world of time, form, material concerns, and so on is samsara, ignorance. And that's how early Buddhists thought. But, you know, later Buddhists began to question that. And I'm so glad they did. Because, you know, actually, when you begin to think that way, everything in the world becomes an obstacle to your waking up. This is not such an uncommon thing, you know. There are certainly religious traditions today where people look at the material world, or they look at what Buddhism calls the world of form, as basically a realm of illusion. This is just a realm of illusion that we have to transcend. And when we transcend the realm of illusion, we enter a timeless place, and that's our true home, right? It's like a little bit like heaven, right? Like heaven. But actually, that's not what the Buddha taught. If you look at the early Pali Sutras, it's how the Buddha was understood by his early followers. The Buddha actually didn't say that, but it for about 400 years, many Buddhists thought that was what the Dharma was all about. But at the same time, there were other Buddhists who had different experiences on and off the cushion. So, for example, you know, if you've been sitting, if you've been meditating for an hour or two, and you walk around outside and you hear a bird, you know, actually, you can enter deep samadhi. It's an interesting thing, right? You know, if you at Sesshin at our meditation retreats, you know, we meditate something like 8 hours a day, and usually around day two or day three, the mind is in this very—it's really been transformed by the sitting practice, and it does involve being motionless on a cushion. It's true, but you know, you might get up and be cutting vegetables in the kitchen. Or you might be mopping the floor. And when you look at your mind, you realize, you know, my mind is in deep samadhi. You know, it's bright and clear, and there isn't a thought in there, you know. Now, you know, actually, this early Buddhists would have been confused by this, right? Because they thought, well, you know, the world of form is samsara, and this timeless, motionless world is nirvana. But, you know, actually, when we practice meditation, you get off the cushion and you walk around, or you drink a bowl of tea at the end of the evening of sitting, you know, you'll notice that you enter into deep samadhi sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. And the more you practice, actually, the more possible it is to be in deep samadhi off the cushion, walking around, even doing things like working at your word processor. You know, you'll be working at your word processor and suddenly you look at your mind and you realize you're in deep samadhi. So this idea that enlightenment is about stillness, immobility, and so on, was an idea that the early Buddhists accepted. And a related idea was that this world is impure or defiling. You know, the idea is that when you are at your job, you know, you might be under some stress and you might have some difficulties. Maybe you come home and you, on the way home, you're going by a Dairy Queen and you think, you know, I've had a rough day, I'm going to go have a Dairy Queen. And you pull in and you have a Dairy Queen ice cream. And you think, oh, this is so good, right? You know, early Buddhists might have said, you know, you're defiling your mind with this, right? It's defiling. Or if you say, you know, I love French fries, I'm going to make some French fries, and you eat some French fries, it's like you're defiling your mind. But actually, you know, when you say, you know, there's such a thing as having an ice cream samadhi, if I may say so, right? Where you actually have an ice cream and it's, you look at your mind and you're in deep samadhi. So this idea that there's a world of form and there's a formless world and that they're separate and that our job is to separate ourselves as much as possible from the formless world is actually, from the standpoint of Zen and Mahayana Buddhism, later Buddhism, a big mistake. That reality is more complex than that. It's actually more complex than that. So here's an example of why that way of thinking doesn't really work. You know, let's say you are able to get into deep samadhi and then you go into emptiness. You know, you sit down on the cushion, you're watching the breath, and you start calling mu, and your mind becomes empty and dark. And you call mu, or in Chinese, wu, wu. And each time you call mu, your mind becomes empty and dark, empty and dark. And then one day, while you're sitting, it just goes totally blank. And this will happen to you. If you practice long enough, your mind will just be absolutely blank. It's like you fall into this Grand Canyon of emptiness sometimes. And you might go into Dokusan and say, my God, I can't believe what just happened to me. My mind became totally blank. There was like this vast, vast emptiness. So, you know, the next day you get on the cushion and you get into deep samadhi and your mind goes totally blank and you want to stay in that vast emptiness. So you get into that deep emptiness and then all of a sudden, you know, you hear a bird or you suddenly, like a piece of music pops into your head. Or you become aware of the sound, excuse me, the sound of somebody, sound of somebody next to you on the cushion breathing. And you think, oh, I have lost my beautiful emptiness. You know, I'm back in the world of form. How sad. This is common. And, you know, when we get into samadhi, we get into deep emptiness, that's part of enlightened mind. That's part of enlightened mind. Being able to do that is essential, indispensable. But it's like inadequate understanding of the path. Because it's not the case that there's something called form and there's something called emptiness and they're totally separate, or there's something called samadhi and there's something called ordinary consciousness and they're totally opposed. They only seem that way. You know, the more you practice, the more you realize that it's not like that, right? It's not like that. You know, the mind is a little bit like, it's like a complex, the mind is a complex system, if I may say so. It's like a complex ecology, if I want to put it that way. You know, if you look at a stream, the stream is flowing all the time, but sometimes there's rocks in the stream, and the rocks produce calm areas, right? Like eddies, we say. Calm, you know. So you're looking at this stream, which is always moving, and there are these rocks that are holding the water, and where the rock is holding the water, there's just no motion at all. This is like, and you know, if you look at the stream, there's places where it's running sort of madly, and there's places where it's absolutely still. And actually, these things go together. These things go together. So, you know, actually, the mind is both motionless and moving at the same time, if that makes any sense. You know, some of this is a little, it doesn't necessarily translate well into ordinary language, but, you know, sometimes when you are in deep samadhi and you're listening to the wind howl outside the zendo, you realize that that wind is really howling, but it's absolutely motionless. And that these two things are actually happening, these are actually both true. So you know, if you think about reality, if you want to put it that way, if you think about reality as a kind of interplay between this motionlessness and what seems to be moving, that's a much more accurate understanding of the way things really are. So, if you go to work and you have a very busy day and you are really working and you're really caught up in everything, you know, you could come home and say, wow, what a crazy day. I can't wait to get back to the cushion and calm down. And that, please do. Please sit on the cushion. Please calm down. Please go into deep samadhi. But, you know, when you're a like more advanced practitioner, you know, you'll be in your crazy day and, you know, this will be happening and that'll be happening and this will be going wrong and that'll be going wrong. And if you just stop for a moment and you pause, you look at your breath and you watch your breath and you turn back at your mind, you notice that your mind is absolutely, can be absolutely still and calm. And that these two things are really not separate. We experience them separately sometimes, but the more advanced we are in our practice, the more we understand that these two things are really not, they're different in our minds, but they're really not different. The more you meditate, the more clear it is that these are not mutually exclusive. And this has a huge impact, I think, on how we live, right? Because, you know, if you're always trying to protect yourself from noise, from chaos, from craziness, you're creating a barrier between yourself and the world that actually causes a lot of emotional distress and prevents you from fully waking up. You know, what you want to do is to go into the craziness, if I may say so. It's like merging yourself with what's happening around you. And when you do that, you realize your mind is absolutely still. Absolutely still. So this is, you know, we want to, when things seem to be getting craziest, we want to withdraw and go into our stillness. But actually, this creates a divided world, which is not the teaching of Buddhism, right? it's not not the teaching of the Buddha. It's a divided world where there's chaos and there's order and there's stillness and there's, you know, some the opposite of stillness, whatever it is. But actually, those two are not different. And as I say, you know, when you at some point in your practice, you might be in the middle of chaos, and if you've done enough sitting, you look back at your mind and you realize it's absolutely still. It's still in the middle of all this madness. And in fact, you know, the madness helps you to be still, if that makes any sense. You know, when we, earlier I mentioned that when you go into deep mushin and you try to stay there, you can't stay there. You go into deep emptiness, and then all of a sudden you hear a bird, or you feel pain in your leg, or you think about lunch, or you hear somebody breathing, and you think, oh, I'm just not good enough yet. You know, if only I could stay in that emptiness. But that's a misjudgment about what reality is like. The emptiness, you could say that the sound comes out of the emptiness. And it works the other way, too. If you listen to a sound long enough, your mind becomes completely empty. So you know, Zen people understand that emptiness and form and emptiness really aren't different. You could say that they're different sides of the same coin, or they're actually different perspectives on the same thing. And so, you know, it's not, it's important to calm down, sit down on the cushion, stabilize your mind, and enter the deepest possible samadhi you can. But, you know, you get off the cushion, and when you get off the cushion and you are experiencing like the madness around you, if you become one with that, you will notice that you return to deep samadhi even in the midst of all that craziness. And this is a more enlightened way to experience the world. This is what now, you know, we recite the Shin Shin Ming in the morning, and no boundaries are seen. You see, Seng San says at one point in the poem, no boundaries are seen. You know, boundaries, stillness and disorder are opposites, and there's a boundary between those. But when you can be in deep samadhi in the midst of all this motion, no boundaries are seen. And so, you know, it's very important to do a lot of meditation, but, you know, as you're a more advanced practitioner, the boundary between on the cushion and off the cushion begins to become less and less clear. You know, you can be in the deepest samadhi while you're mopping the floor. And in fact, you can have deep samadhis because you've mopped the floor. Ryuan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? Yanto said, moving. Ryuan said, what? Really? When moving, what then? Yanto said, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Ryuan stood there thinking. Yanto said, look, if you are not yet free of sense and matter, if you agree, you are not yet free of sense and matter. If you don't agree, you are forever sunk in birth and death. So Ryuan has to do a little bit more sitting. He's still clinging to like the stillness of the samadhi experience, instead of using everything that comes his way in life to wake up. Everything is helping me to wake up. Everything in life is, in one of the koans it says, everything is your rice. Everything is feeding you. Everything is helping me to wake up. Even quarantine, even, you know, what's happening right now. So please continue to practice, and please continue to practice on and off the cushion. And when you feel a little overwhelmed, just say to yourself, Everything is helping me to wake up. Verse, the round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. See, this is, we're running out of time, but this is such an important point. You know, if we lived on a mountaintop and somebody brought us food every day and we just did meditation, we could not really wake up very easily. Could happen. But, you know, the things that help us wake up are the things that rub us the wrong way, if I may say so. It's like, you know, if you have a stone, and, you know, my brother-in-law used to make jewelry, and he had what was called a tumbler. And you take these, like, agates, these raw agates, and you put them in the tumbler, and there's some kind of, like, pumice in the tumbler. And these stones tumble and tumble and tumble until they get more and more circular and polished. And at the end, you take it out, and it's like somebody has polished this thing for a million hours because it's been in a tumbler polishing. It's like the rough edges are worn away. So, you know, we all have experiences that are like being in that tumbler. You know, but everything that happens to us is helping us to become smooth, right? So eventually, in the midst of anything, your mind is absolutely still. It takes a lot of practice and a lot of living to get there, but that's definitely the goal. The round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. You can meet people who have no edges. Their edges have been worn away. Removing the road of agreement, senses, and matter are empty. The free body resting on nothing stands out unique and alive. It's like no matter what's happening in Samadhi, on the cushion, off the cushion, this is the goal. So we're all on this road together. Thank you so much for coming, and I hope to see you very soon.